Hello and welcome to episode 5 of the Back to Front Show. My name is still Keir Whittaker, and once again, I'm joined by Mr. Kieran Masterton. Good afternoon, Kieran.
Hello, how are you?
I'm very well today, very well. Are you by the open fire this week?
No, I am. I'm back in the study.
Back in the study. No boy races outside the window this week?
Well, no, plenty probably, but a bit less audible.
Are they sort of low-slung cars with big exhausts around your way, or what's
yeah,
the sort of...
Vauxhall Nova body kit, that kind of thing.
Body kit and Vauxhall Nova. Vauxhall Novas. Yeah. I learned to drive in one of those. It takes me back. What car did you learn to drive in?
I think it might have been a VW Polo.
Ah, nice.
Yeah, classy. Nice.
Yeah, no boot, really.
Not really, no.
Small
little
car.
Hatch.
Little hat, hot hatch. Anyway, but once again, we're joined, as well as being joined by you, Handheld are sponsoring this week's show again. Handheld
they
Conf.
Are indeed, yeah.
Thanks to them. The early birds have all sold out now.
Wow.
It sounds like it's a popular sort of event that's going to happen down there on November 27th and 28th in Cardiff, UK.
Mm-hmm.
Europe's biggest stage. I'm intrigued to know how would you find that out? Do the research. So you measure your stage and your venue. I mean, can you Google
Is it the physically biggest stage, or is it the most people that can fit in front of a stage?
Surely that would be, say, like Wembley.
Biggest capacity, that would be, wouldn't it?
Surely
that would
be like Wembley or a stadium or something. Yeah. We need to speak to Craig and find out the definition of what Europe's largest stage actually means, I think.
It's impressive, though.
It is. I mean, if it's true, which I'm sure it is, it is impressive. Maybe there's so much stage, there's only 4 seats. I don't know.
Yeah, could be.
I don't know. I don't think that's the case. But we had a good winner on our competition last week.
You chose Dave.
Yeah, very impressive use of the word handheld.
Yeah, lovely.
He was the only one who actually came up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, said his friend needed his handheld, which I thought was brilliant. And hopefully he's got his free ticket to the event and we can meet him there.
Yes.
So, no news on 5x5 still. And I'm probably going to stop talking about it. He's not listening, Dan. So
no, definitely not. I think we should drop it.
Yeah, I think we should drop it and set our...
Independence the way forward.
Yeah, and set our aspirations a little lower, more realistic. Yeah. But thank you for everyone who's listening. And, if you feel like badgering Dan Benjamin, then you can. That's good. Good enough for me. But I've got a new strap line for the show.
Oh, God. Go ahead.
Yeah, no, this is from... in relation to a tweet from Mark Roberts, our friend Mark Roberts.
Oh, yeah.
Questioning why we zero pad our episode numbers.
Is that developer thing
creeping in? So how about this, the only zero padded podcast on the web? What do you reckon about that?
Yeah,
it's good enough for at least five more episodes.
Yeah
It won't be quite as effective once we have only 1-0, but there you go.
No.
Clever
nonetheless.
Well, maybe. But also I'd like to shout out to Richard Wiggins this week. Apparently he's listened to every single episode.
Our biggest fan, yeah?
Yeah, our biggest fan, probably. I said nice. I'd dedicate this episode to him.
Nice.
And he'll only know, of course, if he listens to episode 5. But there we go. Hopefully he will. Actually, I bumped into a few people. I was down at the Responsive Day Out.
Mm.
Down on the coast in Brighton last week.
Which I couldn't make it to.
No, you couldn't make it to. Which also meant you missed my Shopify meetup.
I did, yeah. I thought it was a workshop.
No, well... you and a few other people.
Yes.
No, it was booze... hoodies, Shopify sunglasses, which were very cool, actually.
Nice.
Yeah, not much call for the sunglasses, though, sadly, in Brighton in February/March.
No.
But there you go. But it was a good day, actually.
Good?
Yeah, no, it's really, really interesting. I really like the format, actually, of the event. I've been lucky enough to attend a couple of web events in my time, and this was a new format, which Jeremy Keith, who organised it, said he appropriated off someone else, but... a good format is a good format. So basically it was 3 talks of around 20 minutes each, followed by some Q&A.
Okay, nice.
He had a couple of nice orangey-red sofas on the stage there.
Mm.
And I'm not sure when Jeremy got up in the morning, he chose his shirt that well because it absolutely blended into the upholstery.
But nice.
But luckily he stood up for most of the Q&A. But yeah, again, one of these things, responsive web design been around for... Well, Ethan's article is not yet 3 years old, and it just shows how far sort of... thinking around it has come in that time, and many, many questions, not so many answers. But yeah, really interesting talks, things about games, console browsers from Anna Deben, and that was really fascinating.
Yeah.
Completely different world.
It's a world I don't know much about, actually.
Yeah, me neither. And even things that are coming out now, the browsers are very, sort of downscale from the browsers we're used to, say on iOS or Android, or these kind of things. There's a great talk by Andy Hume, who works, he's ex-Clearleft actually, works at The Guardian now, talking about sort of loading page, you know, loading assets into mobile, the m.guardian website.
Oh, right, yeah.
And there's a whole bunch of other stuff about asset fonts. Jeremy's made all the audio available on HuffDuffer. I've linked it up. I'll put the link to that in the show notes, Which,
Shut that out.
Yeah, I'm sure it will make... it'll still be worth a listen, even if you haven't got the slides. I think most of those are available. But the video, courtesy of B-Square, which is also Craig, guy behind Handheld Conference, will be available soon. So, yeah, lots of questions. A really good day out. £50 as well, ridiculously cheap.
I was frustrated because I bought a ticket, but, clients.
Clients, yes, yeah. Clients.
I pass it on to a good home.
Good home. Mm-hmm. Actually, did you pass it on to our friend Neil?
Yes, our friend Neil, who then had to pass it on again because he's in the middle of a sprint.
Yes, he's in the middle of a sprint, a mixture sprint. But actually, obviously can't talk about it, but very excited by said sprint. Hopefully, if you're on the mixture cool alpha, I was about to say alpha beta testing. I mean, that makes no sense at all.
No, it doesn't.
Alpha testing.
Alpha user, yeah.
Alpha user, there you go. You should be very excited tomorrow.
Yes, extremely. And
it's probably ruined your weekend. You're not going to see your family or anything. You'll be playing with mixture. That sound wrong? Probably.
Probably.
But anyway, why don't you start off this week with, we've got a couple of links each, as always, in our sort of format to talk about. Why don't you start off? Yeah, well, what have you got for us?
Such, just more things that have caught our eye.
Our roving eye.
Yeah, so the first thing that I picked out was a special report by Contents Magazine. Do you follow Contents Magazine at all?
Yeah. I know a few of the people behind it and often dig in and have a read.
So I can't say I'm a regular reader, but this really caught my eye just because it's something that's quite sort of close to my heart about data protection.
Yeah.
Not in a sort of health and safety,
I don't know. I did read this in the show notes. I was like, special report #1, data protection. I was like, what has he been reading?
It's going to be a bit heavy.
Section 4, paragraph 3.
No, basically the special report by Condon's Magazine is about essentially bad practice when it comes to users' data. And there's loads of apps out there with tons of UGC and
user-generated content. Yeah.
User-generated content, yes. And so they're really, people building their apps off the back of people's photographs or comments or reviews or whatever it might be.
Hmm.
And then either selling their business, being bought out, or having a falling out, or abandoning the project, or changing the original a pivot, or whatever you want to call it, changing the original purpose, and then the sort of perceived framework under which that you agreed to upload that data suddenly changes. And the classic example, of course, is Instagram, when Facebook bought them, and everybody was up in arms about what's going to happen to my content.
Yeah, I mean, the classic there was people sort of saying, pictures of my kids going to be used in advertising on Facebook and all that kind of thing, weren't they?
Well, exactly, yeah. Or, I think it's actually a bit, the more interesting issue for me is when things shut down rather than when something's bought.
Yeah, exactly. There were a couple of apps there, weren't there? Delicious, Gowalla.
GeoCities.
And I guess more recently, Posterous as well, which Twitter bought and have mothballed.
I know this Jeremy Keith particularly, this is a subject that he's very passionate about, and he's one of the people credited on this article. The idea that huge chunks of documents effectively that would probably previously have been on paper now or digital, and we are without wishing to get too heavy about it, we're the guardians of that data. And it's very easy to go, I tried this product or this service or whatever, or I can't make it work financially for me, so I need to shut it down, and then think, not many people were using it anyway, so
only 10,000 people or something, or
exactly.
Half a million
You say to yourself, well, don't worry about the data. I can always do an exploit if someone's particularly bothered. But I think what they're trying to do is they're trying to lay out a set of guidelines. I think they have three guidelines there about how to treat people's data. And if you do shut the service down, or if it is bought out, to ensure that there's some sort of clause to say that, you know, at least for a financial quarter, the data should be available to, you know, download. I know that the milk guys at Milk did this, yeah, with their product. You know, for a financial quarter, you leave it open, and then, you know, there's an opportunity beyond that for a year to get the content, but just for the cost of storing the data, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, I'm sure you're the same. You sign up for all these new things and you interact, yeah, with them for a few months, or you don't. And, yeah, things don't work out. I think it's a fact of life. Some applications aren't going to work. They can't sustain the people involved. So on the one hand, I understand that. On the other, you know, when things are mothballed or all this kind of stuff, it does raise a lot of questions that we've got very used to this ephemeral nature of data on the web. I mean, I remember, was it Jeremy who spoke about this at not last year's Build, the previous year?
Yeah, that was really, really good.
Yeah, it's like fantastic talk. And he made the point of, even though you think you own a domain, you're only really renting it. So you can rent it for 20 years, but at the somewhat, you know, you have to hand it back unless you keep paying for it. And so, what does this mean about our data? You have these published URLs everywhere, you know, your own website, kieranmarston.com/blog/whatever. Mm-hmm. But if you don't renew that, and obviously it's your name, it's, even though it's your name, you don't have a right to it. You have to pay someone to rent it.
No, of course.
Those canonical, they'll just go. It will disappear. That document will no longer be available. So I think it's a huge problem. It's a really interesting thing that they've done there. And I hadn't come across that. I was reading it earlier today.
No, it's really interesting. And I think Jeremy again made the same point in that talk, that, you know, we could effectively be the next dark ages, you know, in 100, 200 years time, people might not know anything about what we, you know, how we lived or what we do, because, you know, our data was all digital and, you know, that has a lifespan, you know.
Yeah, we don't have to go back too far in terms of the technology that was more, I guess, more storable. I mean, you know, you could take a CD and you could put it in a vault. Or, yes, you know, a vinyl, yes, record, you could put it in a paper document, a report, etc.
But yeah, I mean, the permanence of documents has disappeared, really.
Yeah, I mean, everything, all my invoicing and receipts are all electronic now. It's when you step back and think about it, it's quite scary. But hey ho. but yeah, no,
it's a good read, and if
it is,
you want to link to it, and I think I'll be trying to follow the guidelines just in terms of, you know, if I start a new service or if I shut one down or whatever, I'll try and make data available.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, you know, it's not too long either. It's, you know, achievable the way, yes, that they explain the sort of outline of, you know, managing data or users' data and that kind of stuff. So definitely worth a read for sure.
Yes, yeah.
What have I got this week? Oh, I found an interesting thing, I guess, relevant to the responsive day out. It was about tracking analytics in Google Analytics in particular, but for responsive sites. And it was an article published on the 7th of Feb by Henry Zeitler. And I'm not sure where it's from. I can't actually pronounce the domain. Maygrun, probably said that wrong. I think it's maybe Dutch or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's a really clever way of using a library, a very small library, called Enquire.js, which allows you to use callback functions in JavaScript when the viewport size either changes or is of a certain size. So let's say, you know, open a site upon your mobile phone and it's, say, 400 or whatever, you can instigate a callback function, or, you know, someone stretches the browser in and out, that kind of stuff. And the point being that your call to action buttons on a page most probably will move and bend and flex and move positions. And so how do you actually measure the effectiveness of those?
If
you've just got one metric, yeah. Yeah. So you might think, actually, it's really performing really badly. And that might be because 90% of your visitors are on a mobile device and the button's right at the bottom.
Sure.
So it goes through how to approach this. I'm sure there's other ways, but this one looks pretty neat. Uses the Enquire.js library, which I've been looking at again, and I think has a lot of use cases.
So when does that callback fire when you rotate the phone as well on
landscape,
portrait, etc.?
Yeah, I believe Enquire. I'll stand corrected on this. It will. You can register for orientation change as well.
That's cool.
So, and then obviously what you do with the callbacks is you can then register different handlers to the buttons for Google Analytics. So, yeah, really interesting using the track event stuff. So yeah, really interesting read. It's nice. A little bit out of date because they recommend using the live handler, which I think has been superseded by the the on handler. But yeah, I think we'll probably see more of this. I still find Google Analytics a little bit complicated, to be honest, when you just want to, you know, there's some steps and hoops I still feel you have to jump through beyond sort of basic metrics. But it's very, very powerful. And definitely worth a read. Have you played with it much in the past?
No, I haven't. No, not at all.
Beyond only sticking the script in the footer of your website type stuff.
Yes, exactly. Yes. Yeah. I mean, you know, mainly implementing it for clients because, as I said, I use gauges
for
everything I do. But that's just because I'm a simplistic fool and only like
far from it. But can you can you interact? Can you with gauges, or is it much more of a sort of monitoring tool? Can you set handlers and all that kind of stuff?
I don't think you can. No, I've never seen anything like that in gauges. It's just it's purely it's the sort of 37 signals approach to. I mean, it's not run by 37 signals, but you know what I mean. It's their approach to analytics, so it's very stripped down, very simple.
Yeah, it's very, very, very nice though.
It is, yeah, and it's a lovely interface, and the live view is particularly fun if you just just launch something or whatever. I've never really exploited Google Analytics to its full potential.
The good news is there are some experts out there that you can rent for thousands of pounds a day.
Yes, that's the good thing about it.
I get emails from them and SEO people quite regularly.
I
got one today actually, and they put the address at the bottom, and it said he lived in the United States.
Oh, nice.
I was like, oh, really? The United States?
I'm not sure if I know that one.
No, it must be the 53rd state or something. I'm not sure. But anyway, but we both picked up on the next one that we're going to sort of, before we move on to our discussion section. And that's Yahoo. And you kind of got to say it with the bang at the end. Yahoo bang. Yahoo. Apparently, I don't know if this is true, but for a long time, if you hovered over the Y on the site and you had your volume turned up, it did sort of sing at you. Is that true?
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
I don't remember that.
Yeah, I believe so. You could probably find a WAV file of the Yahoo.
Yeah.
We'll try and find one, put it in the show notes.
Machine or something.
Yeah. But you've linked up the 37 Signals post. Was it written by DHH, this one?
Yes. And I think I actually, you mentioned to me that Daniel Howells had written about it. I think actually I might have found it via Howells.
Yeah, Mr. Howells.
But
of course, this revolves around Yahoo's. Well, I believe it came down from up high, as they say. Marissa Meyer or Mayer? I never know.
Meyer, I think. Yeah.
About no more remote working at Yahoo.
Yes, which I when I first saw this, I mean, it's been a few weeks since this came out, but I sort of saw it. I think I can't remember. Someone retweeted it, or I saw DHH tweet it out, and I sort of ignored it, not thinking I was not that interested. You know,
ignorance, shocking.
And then when Dan Howells wrote about it, I started thinking about it more and how I felt about it, and how absolutely infuriating it would be if you were an employee at Yahoo and you're a home worker, because you and I both work at home, and obviously we're self-employed, but how frustrating it would be to have had an arrangement like that and then have that pulled from under you.
My initial reaction was, surely that's going to mean some people won't be able to work at Yahoo.
Well, I thought so. You know, if you're as DHH points out in his post, you know, if you're tied to a specific state or a specific place because of your partner's work or whatever it might be, you could have been a valuable asset to Yahoo, but you know, now you have to find your way to an office or a local office anyway.
I love the way we talk about DHH. Like, is he the only man in web that we is regularly abbreviated? It's brilliant. DHH. I mean, it works so
I've
well.
Heard people do it with Jason Santamaria.
JSM. Yeah. True. It does roll off the tongue.
It does, yeah.
It's interesting this, because I think the percentage, I was kind of, my reaction was very, very similar to yours. And I know that the 37 Signal guys are, well, hey, they're writing a book on it, all about remote working and the benefits it brings to an organization. My initial reaction was one of like, well, that just seems ridiculous. I think I was slightly tempered when I found out that the percentage of employees that actually regularly work at home, in inverted commas, was relatively small. But still, it is a massive cultural shift. I was very much like agreeing with what I was reading with DHH. But I think Howell's piece, which is worth, I love the way, again, we just refer to him as Howell's.
At Howell's.
Daniel, who we both know, and, you know, really enjoy his blog if you've not checked it out, howells.ws.
Great content.
Yeah, really, really insightful stuff. His point was, if you're, you know, Yahoo has, needs a cultural shift, it needs bringing back on course, and that's what Marissa Meyer is doing. You know, she's bringing these edicts down to really, I guess from her perspective, unify the company, get all the people working on stuff, interacting. And his thing was, you know, if you're not passionate about the company, if you're working for a big organization that's not necessarily the company that it used to be and you're working from home, the opportunity to not be in the zone and engaged with the work is greater. And so
well,
by bringing
off to be blunt, I mean, I think he was really honest in his post, and I'd say that I agree. You know, I've worked for big companies that I didn't really, you know, for want of a better word, care, you know, about what they were trying to achieve or what they were doing, and they, you know, I felt you did, sort of didn't have the passion there. And so you do have this tendency that if you do work from home, that, you know, it's a little bit of a day off.
Yeah, I don't think he's going back to Accenture anytime soon, put it that way.
Not after that. But yeah, I think that I think he's right. I think it's about, you know, the culture and whether they've engaged you and whether you feel like you're, you know, creating something worthwhile, working on something you care about. And and I guess this comes into what we're going to discuss later, but if you don't get up and you're inspired by what you want to do in the morning.
Yeah.
Then yeah, it's interesting. It's very hard and to do that. And so maybe in some ways, maybe she is doing the right thing to bring them back into the fold and to try and inspire them. But I think that, you know, more than likely the people that work from home are working from home for a reason, and they'll probably have to look elsewhere.
I guess work from home, you know, should be put in quotes, because that could be your coffee shop. It could be a mixture of working the library or wherever. It's, you know, not in the office, I guess is the point.
Yes.
It's interesting, though. I don't really know what other big corporates do. I mean, do Google have an open policy about where you work, for example?
I think Google and Apple both don't allow
interesting.
You to do that. But as DHH says in his post, you know, he feels, anyway, that they can get away with that because they're on top of their game.
Right.
And their staff are energized and excited, and they're doing interesting things, whereas Yahoo's flat as a pancake and has been for a decade almost.
I guess, I mean... I was just thinking, despite the prevalence of communication technologies, whether it be your Basecamps or your Skypes, your IM tools, et cetera, actually being in a room with people that you're working with does reap benefits that I don't think you get over IM or... but then I think you need that space where, you know, you have a meeting, you're energized, you've got shit to do. And then you need that environment where you can go and do it and you feel comfortable that you can sort of just hammer through it.
I think it very much depends on the individuals in the team. I think that I've worked in situations where remote stuff has worked really well. And equally, I've worked in stuff where remote stuff's been a real uphill struggle.
There's interesting...
On the Authentic Jobs podcast, I sort of had heard a similar stuff being discussed about Kickstarter.
Right.
Because they were talking about, I think it's called hired.fm.
That's a great URL, isn't it?
Yeah.
We should get an FM. Can we do that?
On it now.
It's probably like, you know, $100 or something silly.
But they were talking about the same thing about how, you know, all that really changed in their culture when they became in the same space, when they, you know, moved to the same space, was that Skype was taken out of the equation. They still communicated the same way as they did before, and that the team worked the same way, which I thought was interesting, that, you know, they didn't really think the culture had changed much, even though they were in the same room.
Is that the Authentic? Oh, no, Kickstarter, sorry.
That's Kickstarter.
Yeah, interesting. Okay.
Authentic Jobs podcast. So, yeah, I think that it can work, but it really depends on the individuals involved and, I mean, you know, their relationship and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, speaking personally, I kind of need a mix, I think. I need time to sort of, like, working in an office trying to do a podcast would be silly. You know, it just wouldn't happen. But equally, I think getting up in the morning, getting out of the house, having a bit of a routine, that other space, that third space or whatever, that's not your home office for that read bedroom or you know, it's important. And I think, you know, I know a lot of people who have offices, but they still debunk to the coffee shop or...
Yeah,
it's an interesting one. It'd be interesting to see how that pans out and where Yahoo go as a company. I think they will sort of start doing interesting stuff again. But yeah, I mean, it's funny to think that these companies are only sort of 10, 15 years old.
Mm. Yeah, so, they were such giants after such a short time that they're sort of been idling for, you know, a long time now.
The 37 Signals blog, Signals versus Noise, also had another post about their annual sort of meetup.
Yes.
Where every, and the 36 Signals, as they said, all get together in the rather splendid looking Chicago HQ.
Yeah.
And the benefits of that, I think they do it every quarter. I may have got that wrong. So even, you know, have a massively remote team that they still find the benefit in all coming together under the same roof.
It's a big team now, isn't it?
Mm. Yeah, huge, isn't it?
I remember DHH said something like, you know, you should be able to feed your team from two pizzas or something. I can't remember what that was. Was that him?
Well, you know Chicago, they're big pizzas.
Yes, true.
Very big pizzas.
A brick depth of pizza.
Is that the Chicago ones where they put the sauce on top? Is that
deep dish. Yeah.
Good stuff.
Yeah, like soup.
Yeah. I remember going out for a pizza in San Francisco with Ron Richards. What was it called? Patchy's or something like that. And they were the deep dish ones. I'd never had one.
Mm-hmm.
Supplemented by a can of PBR.
Nice.
Glory stuff. Dollar a can. I was like, he's like, you're only going to be able to manage two slices. I'm like, that's ridiculous. Look at it. It's not that big. It's a 12-inch pizza. By 1 1/4.
Yeah.
I wasn't eating my words because there wasn't really much room left. But yeah, my God, it's spinning. We should do a pizza episode.
Just dedicated to pizza, yeah.
Yeah, I think.
Best pizza. Should get Aaron on.
Yes, Mr. Robs, yes. Yeah. And or Mark from MailChimp, who...
That's true, yeah.
...seemed to know more about pizza. Actually, Aaron the other day on Instagram, he seemed to be eating pizza all day. He said, like, I was just, like, flicking through and...
Oh, really? I saw that. It's sort of like a pizza tour of New York.
Yeah, but, like, starting for breakfast and finishing with, you know, pizza and cocktails. Brilliant. Anyway...
I can't say that it sounds painful.
No. It's your idea of heaven, isn't it?
Yeah, pretty much.
But anyway, moving on from pizza, because we literally probably could talk about that for another 25 minutes, to the discussion section for the last sort of 15. And this is this notion of executing on your ideas and actually getting them out the door, otherwise known in the trade as shipping. That's with two P's. Yep. And this was brought on by you reading Execute by Drew Wilson and Josh Long.
Yeah, that's right. I don't know whether I received it late or whether maybe it was international shipping or something. I think it shipped quite a while ago.
Yeah, they forgot about you.
Yeah, probably.
Do you reckon? We can say that about our rival podcast.
I think probably international shipping combined with then redirection from maybe two different addresses.
Yeah, that's never going to work. That's not a proper 301, is it?
No. I'm probably about halfway through it, so I can't say that I've read the whole thing. But
well, no, if you're only halfway through, you can't.
No, true. I'm inspired by it. It's a really interesting book about executing on your ideas the moment that inspiration strikes, and not mulling things over for too long and sitting there planning and finding out every possible thing that could go wrong with it, and therefore you know talking yourself out of a project.
So just give the background to the book is that did they not, I mean, isn't the book in itself, although it talks about a product, is it Spacebox that Drew built very, very quickly and executed on very, very quickly, but wasn't the book also executed very, very quickly?
Yeah, in the same time.
Very meta.
Five days. Spacebox, just to give some background, Spacebox was Drew's creation to try and make Stripe, wonderful payment system in the US.
Rumoured to be coming to the UK.
To make that more accessible to non-coders. So just like you could sign up for PayPal and start taking payments instantly, Spacebox allows you to sign up for Stripe and start taking payments instantly and not require any sort of coding skills. Do you have to interact with their API? You don't have to create a form. You don't have to worry about certificates. You know, there's no technical stuff involved.
Yeah, it's very, very neat, actually. So it basically adds a front-facing layer onto Stripe, which normally you'd need code to interact with, right?
Yes, yeah. So essentially, it makes it as easy for someone to use as PayPal, or actually easier because PayPal's pretty hard to use. But yeah, so and he executed that in 5 days.
Right.
The idea being, you know, get something to market, get your idea out there, make it, you know, have it happen. And you know, so I thought to myself when I looked at the book, to be honest with you, I thought to myself, you know, this could be all fluff. It could just be sort of like, you know, strike while the iron's hot, that kind of thing. But I think there's some interesting stuff in there, you know, particularly around, you know, not stewing over things and, you know, talking yourself out of them and that kind of thing. And also about, you know, and I guess this is similar to the minimum viable product thing, but sort of, you know, building the sort of the smallest, most compact thing you can and stuff. There's a whole bunch of stuff in there that's interesting.
So what do you think you've taken from it? Do you agree with it all? Is this something, how you, is it an approach that you've used yourself? Are you guilty of stewing and pontificating over ideas?
I'm the man with 400 ideas in a notebook.
400 notebooks with 400 ideas in each one, probably.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And to set the record straight, I do execute on ideas. I have shipped stuff, but I think it's and all those things that I have shipped have happened very quickly, which was that's what interested me in the book. You know, it sort of, for example, Open Indie, we did the Kickstarter campaign, and you know, pretty much. I had to leave my full-time job for that, and pretty much 2 weeks later I was coding the thing.
Yeah.
So you know, that's obviously not the same sort of time frame as 5 days, but it's much shorter than most things that I've worked on. So yeah, I think that's why it interested me, really, was because the things that I have done that have been a success have been done over very short time periods.
Yeah, I think that's true. I also think it's about levels of enthusiasm, isn't it, and actually sort of, you know, as you said, striking while the iron's hot, but also less in terms of the net result, but also in terms of your own motivation, and carrying on that momentum, you know, as well through a period of time. It's very easy to get very excited about a product or a service that you might, you know, or an event or something that you want to put on. But once you sit down and you run the numbers and you talk to people and they say one thing and so-and-so says another and all these sound things, and you put them all into the mixing pot, and then you're like, I'll just go back to this, you know. I'll just leave it there for a day or two. Yeah, I definitely look forward to borrowing your copy.
Yes.
once you've read it. Sure. I think I mean, shipping is one of those things that I try to do more of. Whether it be like even just setting yourself a schedule to write a blog post, or you know, doing something like this. I've been wanting to podcast for the last 18 months or so. And you know, I had the Blue Yetis for a long time and just done nothing with them. I think that's a mixture of things. You know, finding someone who would want to chat on a sort of bi-monthly basis, who's got time or inclination, all those kind of things as well, feels comfortable with it. So there's always competing factors that stop you doing things. But I think the more we do, the more you put out, the more you learn. Even if you go down the road of building something or trying something and it doesn't work out for whatever reason, or you don't feel that it's worked out, you're going to learn something from it, aren't you? Whether that be technological or collaborating with someone new, or a new technique, or something that you will ultimately use in another project. So I think trying these things, not thinking too much about them, maybe, you know, it's probably a good thing, right?
No, I think so. Yeah, I think, and you know, one of the things that Drew was obviously was, it's sort of done in an interview style. I mean, not quite an interview style. It's almost like Josh is interviewing Drew, but recounting that. He says that Drew said, you know, that he basically, his process is talk to a friend, get inspired, have an idea, you know, have an idea, Google it. If it doesn't exist, build it. That's how he works.
I mean, Drew's done an awful lot. Actually, I met him at the first Brooklyn Beater I went to, which was a couple of years back. And he was saying how he had all these ideas and they weren't necessarily working. And he was trying them, and he had a family and stuff. And then he released Pictos, the icon set. And suddenly, you know, he was sustaining himself off an icon set. And this is a $30 icon set. And you think, gosh, you must be doing some serious volume. And on the back of that, he started building all these other ideas. So it just shows that something as what you might perceive as a trivial amount of cash, a $30 icon set, and it's a very nice icon set, don't get me wrong, has allowed him that jump, you know, by executing on that and getting it out the door, has allowed him to sort of build this suite of products and ideas out. You know, he's got websites, he's got conferences, he's got apps. Yeah, you know, I believe he even managed to go surfing. I mean, what's up with that?
Yeah, I think a lot of this is about the bulk of the introduction is about them not, you know, not they don't want to change your life in a sort of, you know, inspirational speaker type way, but saying that, you know, if you are stuck in a sort of stuck in a rut or whatever, you know, it's going to be a lot of hard work, but you can execute something relatively small, you know, in a relatively small amount of time that can completely change everything, is what they're trying to say.
Well, it's funny, we linked up nice.co last week by Armstrong & Co. And I was chatting to him earlier this week, and I was sort of, he was telling me how he came up with the idea in a notebook while waiting for a plane, did some of the markup on his laptop on the plane, and then pinged it out to, you know, 10 of his closest associates when he landed at Gatwick. And a couple of them jumped on board to help him sort of prototype it. So that's only been out there 2 or 3 weeks.
Cool.
And you just think, yeah, well, you know, it's a great idea. It's simple, but that's a positive. It does one or two things very, very well. And he's got it out the door.
Yeah.
You know? And he can now iterate on that and rebuild it and all these kind of things. Mm. Do you think this is a lot different to, you know, the term that it's certainly if you read kind of startup news or any of that kind of stuff, MVP, minimal viable product. Is this different to that? Is it a different approach? Yeah, or
they're trying to push themselves away. They actually say, you know, we're not trying to do a lean startup here or anything like that. They're trying to talk very specifically about inspiration. And one of the things that that resonated with me was the passages about, you know, you're not going to get inspired if you sit there trying to be inspired, and you're not going to be inspired necessarily in front of your computer if you're not that sort of person, or, you know, it's just the sort of the things that should be obvious but aren't always obvious, you know.
Yeah.
Where you know I'll often sit there with a notebook and a coffee and think to myself, what, you know I had all these ideas, you know, 2 days ago, why can't I think of any of them? Why can't I start putting them down on paper? And it's probably because you're not in the right frame of mind, or you're not in the right place. And it sort of just says, you know, either go to the gym or go for a walk, or, you know, you could go out with friends or whatever, just to try and take your mind off the problem, and then you'll probably think of it or whatever.
Yeah, I think that's so true, actually.
Yeah, it's this. I think a lot of us, and I'm guilty of this terribly, is you get cabin fever because you're stuck in the house or you're stuck in the office or whatever, and you sort of, your world shrinks to the size of your 15-inch display or whatever it is, and it's important to sort of, you know, go out and not look at the screen for a bit.
Yeah, you're bragging on your 15-inch Retina display again, aren't you?
Well, yeah, that was.
You didn't want to put that in.
No, yeah. Obviously, but glad you did it.
I as I said earlier, I think if I may borrow it, or I should probably buy it. I really should buy it.
Probably should, yeah.
Probably should. It'd be the honourable thing. Yeah. I'm interested to read it, and you know, just a couple of points that you mentioned before we hit the record button. I've been trying a lot more recently to turn off things like Twitter, Tweetbot, and the mail app and all that kind of stuff. And it really does help. It's surprising. You know, getting away from push notifications and all those kind of things really means you can just focus in on what you're doing. And it's where along the line did we all get so used to getting an email and answering it? I think, you know, straight away. The amount of emails I send thinking, right, they're done. And this, and I've got boom, 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 boom. You know, people have replied. I'm like, wow. Okay. Guy called Toby, who's one of the co-founders of Shopify, mentioned in a team email that he only opens the Gmail client on the web three or four times a day. He uses something called Sanebox, I think it is, which kind of is a sort of add-on to Gmail that really helps sort of filter things into different folders and various other things depending on certain rules. He turns off push notifications on any device. And anything that's left in his inbox on a Sunday at 9 p.m., he basically archives.
Wow.
Boom. Wow. I mean, you know, he's a co-founder of a very successful company. I'm sure he gets a lot of demands on his time and his email as well. Yeah. So I thought that was quite interesting. You know, he said, if it hasn't had my attention by that time, it's not important.
Wow.
Interesting.
I guess you know, that's similar to some of the things that Kevin Rose has said about, you know, you don't do email for X amount of time, only send 1, 2, or 3 sentence replies, that kind of stuff. But again, that I think that, you know, works really well if you, as you say, are successful founder of a company or something, and you've got loads of demands on your time, and you probably don't necessarily need to look at every opportunity that comes your way.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So, yeah, I'm trying to get better at that myself. Mm. We'll see. Oh, I've just got it. Oh, who's that? No. So I should turn it off. Sorry. That was a joke. Lame one at that. But anyways, yeah. Talking of lame, you've tried to up my "and finally" section.
Yeah.
Plaidmaker last week. Actually, Sean at Plaidmaker on Twitter actually mm-hmm. listened to the show.
Nice.
Yeah. I didn't realise he was the man behind Stashist as well. That is actually his other site.
Oh, it's his site as well, is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
we should get into that because there'll be silence on the end of the podcast again. If we
I know, I'm not going to open it up. Mustaches. Too many good moustaches. But this week, another fascination, well, particularly of mine, I think you're getting into the party as well, cocktails.
I mean, sort of dragged, kicking and screaming. And,
yeah, I mean, you are a kind of warm whiskey man.
Warm whiskey, yes.
By fire, with your Labradoodle warm beer, in Scotland.
Warm beer and whiskey. Is
frothing ale.
Yeah, yes. Hoppy.
I blame the Somerset upbringing.
Well, yeah. Wouldn't that be cider?
Well, I suppose it would, wouldn't it? Are you a cider man? I've never seen with a jar of Scrumpy.
Probably got drunk on it too much as a child.
Is that thing?
Adult.
Is that thing about putting the rat in the cider? Is that true when they to test how?
I think it's something about protein. So I'm not entirely sure if that is true, but there's something about that it needs protein to start the process.
So they put a rat in there.
Something about that. Yeah, they put a dead rat in, but I suspect they're probably not the case. Sure. They probably put some sort of culture in that starts it.
I'm sure the European Union rules on putting rats in cider. Put paid well,
horses and rats and
yeah anyway that's Somerset for you, but anyway, so what a great name, Bartendro. Tell us all about it.
Well, I only know really as much as the Kickstarter video that tells me. It's a Kickstarter campaign for a couple of guys who have a company called Party Robotics, which I thought was pretty cool.
They're based in San Luis Obispo,
indeed, in California.
Nice part of the world.
And it's a hardware project on Kickstarter, and they are a robotics company, obviously, as the name suggests. And it's a software guy and a hardware guy who are working together on a project that has created a robot that mixes cocktails for you.
It's brilliant. A automatic mixologist, a sort of robotic mixologist.
Yes, and they can control the quantities of each different spirit to ridiculous,
to 1 mil.
To 1 mil, yeah. And you can get them, and there's a whole range of options available on the pledge. It's quite expensive, some of them, but you can get up to a 15 shot robot.
Brilliant, absolutely brilliant. Can you imagine installing one of those in an office? It's like and you can control, is it true that you can control, they also, one of the other things you want to do is have an open source, so that's the thing, it's all going to be open source tech, open mm-hmm. source software, but yeah. they also want to create the world's best open source drinks database that will drive the Bartendro.
That's it, yeah.
So you can say, give me a Mai Tai so-and-so style, and it will go off and mix it all up for you.
Yeah, they'll access their API, get that information, and mix it for you.
I mean, yeah. I don't know how they do an old-fashioned, which requires all the stirring and the cherry.
I don't know. Actually, I think they actually mention old-fashioned in the video.
They do.
Yeah, but maybe it's this is the thing I thought. I wondered if purists. I'm sure maybe Ben Bodine will at us and say what.
You're about to say. I'm sure if Ben's listening, I don't know if he listens.
No, it's true.
He might not be one of the five.
But I think that it could be that the cocktail. Obviously, all it can do, I guess, is mix the cocktail.
It's not all. I mean, have you seen it? It's like
tubes
and pipes and. Actually, Richard Wiggins, who we dedicated this episode to, is... no, I mean, he's still with us. It's not like,
passed away.
No, nothing like that. But he's a cocktail guy.
Is he?
Okay. Yeah, he's got a great book. I think it's called Duffield's Guide to Cocktails or something. He tweeted a picture of it. I was like, oh, I've got to get that. I looked on. It's about £40.
Bloody hell.
I trust it was a present.
Yeah.
Although if he bought that for himself, he's massively gone up in the world. that's a good way to spend your money. But so maybe... Maybe Richard, if you are listening, you can check out the Bartendro and let us know your thoughts.
I'm trying to find the price for a 15 Bartendro 15. I'm trying to. Here we go.
You couldn't go for a single shot though. That would just be kind of pointless.
Rubbish,
No. You like your warm whiskey.
Well, I do, but I can pour myself a single shot. So a Bartendro 15 starter kit. So that's the biggest size they make, I think. I think they might do a custom, but the biggest, yeah, custom you can have. So customs start from 10 grand US.
Snip.
Yeah, bargain. And someone's bought a Bartendo 15 at $2,300.
Oh, that's a bargain.
Yeah.
I think if we ever get any more sponsorship, it's and the campaign's still
that's
open.
That's what's going on, is it?
But I forgot to mention that you control it from your iPhone.
Oh, yeah. It's all
so you can be sat there, smartphone. You can be lounging and just call up your cocktail, basically.
Yeah, and also the version that they show on in the video has an iPad mounted, so you just walk up to it and tap what you want, and it produces the goods.
It's brilliant, seriously. So you can add a Microsoft Kinect to the top of the bot, or a card reader for payment or age verification, a breathalyzer, social networking or drink suggestions. Brilliant.
Incredible.
Integrate stirring and shaking, an ice dispenser or a conveyor belt to move several glasses through the bar. This, and you can check out the source code on GitHub.
Nice.
This is genius. Honestly, I might just pledge $5 just for the hell of it and get a sticker.
Just to be involved, yeah.
Just to say I had a hand.
Just to say you were there.
Yeah. And you've got all stands and everything. I hope this makes it. I'm going to keep an eye on it.
What's the current status? It's about halfway.
So 216 backers, $66,993 pledged of the $135,000 goal. But there's 24 days to go.
That's a high pledge per backer.
That is.
So they're about halfway, and 80% of campaigns that go over halfway fund.
It's an average of $310.15.
Wow. That's high, isn't it?
Hmm. $5. What would I get for $5? A shout out. And a sweet die-cut sticker of our logo.
There you go.
That I will give to you because I don't really use stickers.
Well, I don't really either, but I just stockpile them.
Yeah. What do you do with them? You've got a drawer. Is it in the man drawer?
The man drawer.
Along with scissors and random
a set of
tools.
Man drawers. Yeah.
Well, Again, another show. But anyways, I'm going to keep an eye on that. We'll put the link in the show notes. It does look like an essential for any modern tech startup, actually.
Yeah, I think so. Don't buy the foosball tower, buy this.
Yeah, can you imagine? Do you think this would increase productivity and increase execution?
Without a doubt. More than an Xbox. More than a Wii.
Yeah, I mean, everyone likes a cocktail, right? Yeah,
exactly.
I mean, the amount of Wiis you see in offices that are basically gathering dust.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, is it acceptable if you have a Wii in an office, suddenly down tools at any given moment and play it?
Well, like 9:15.
Yeah, like, come in, just quick go on the Wii, maybe do some Wii Fit, you know?
Yeah, I wonder. I've never worked in an office with one, so I don't know what the sort of etiquette is around it. Whether it's a strictly lunchtime activity, or whether you can just, you know, down tools and go and do it.
Because you could say if they had the Wii Fit, and you'd be paid to keep fit, and as a result of being paid to keep fit in the office, it increased your productivity in the hours of the day that you weren't keeping fit.
You could claim that. Yes.
Do you think that would fly?
Mm, yeah, definitely.
I think it would at Yahoo.
Yeah.
Anyway. So we've actually managed 48 minutes. That's probably, we've chatted far too long about the Bartendro.
Yeah.
But it's worth it. As a great spot. I think as an and finally section, that's probably up there now with stashes.com. Yeah, up probably. This is like weekly almost.
Almost.
Well.
Let's not promise anything. Come on.
Now I've still got to edit it.
Yes.
And take out all the you knows.
Be about 5 minutes.
Five-minute one, yeah, which is fine. You know, a microcast.
You know.
I did it, didn't I? I can't believe it. Anyways, right. We will be back. We will be back. Hopefully, within our 2 weeks, maybe sooner. Who knows? And if you have any feedback about cocktails or tech or anything in between, that's front end technology, back end server stuff. Anything really, we don't mind. Give us an email, Kier, that's KEIR at backtofrontshow.com. Should we go to backtofrontshow.fm? We should check that out.
We should check
it out. Or at us, as the kids say on Twitter, back to front show on Twitter as well. But as always, thank you to listening, and thank you, Mr. Wiggins, for if you've listened to all the way to the end, then you've listened to every single show we've ever done.
Thank you to HandheldConf.
Oh, of course. HandheldConf for your generous support of the show. We'll be back soon. Thanks again. Cheers.